Chapter 1. Early Years. Cleveland was baptized Stephen Grover, but he never used the Stephen after he grew up. He was the fifth of the nine children and third son of the Reverend Richard Fawley Cleveland and Ann Neal, a native of Baltimore. There, her father, Abner Neal, made a living as a bookseller and publisher of law books. He and his family had immigrated recently from Ireland, possibly fleeing the consequences of involvement in the 1798 uprising against the British crown. Anne's mother, Barbara Reel, was a Quaker of German background from Germantown, Pennsylvania. The new baby, then like his siblings, would be regarded as a typical American, an amalgam of English, Irish, and German stock. The father of the future president was a Yale graduate, class of 1824. Ordained into the Presbyterian ministry at the Princeton Theological Seminary in 1829. Having fallen in love with Ann Neal while he was a tutor in Baltimore, he and she were married the same year. The fledgling minister's maiden pastorate was the First Congregational Church of Windham, Connecticut. To the dismay of her husband's new flock, his bride arrived on the scene accompanied by a black maid and garbed in a flashy dress, her wrists jangling with bracelets. Quickly, though, she sent the maid back to Baltimore, took off the jewelry, and began comporting herself in less dazzling fashion as a devoted helpmate to her husband. Richard Cleveland worked so hard in his post that he fell ill. Friends, believing that he needed a change of scene, obtained a pulpit for him in a Presbyterian church in Portsmouth, Virginia. The spirited Anne was pleased that once more she could put on her jewelry and dress as she pleased. 2 years later, in 1835, Reverend Richard was called to the pastorate of the Presbyterian congregation in Caldwell, New Jersey. There, he came under the influence of the Reverend Stephen Grover, an aging minister long associated with the church, who was filling in the pulpit until the Clevelands got there. When their fifth child arrived soon afterward, it seemed apt to name him for the admired elderly cleric. The tiny village of Caldwell, where Stephen Grover Cleveland came into the world, was originally known as Horseneck. It had been renamed in 1798 in honor of James Caldwell, a minister whose exploits during the Revolution in support of Washington and his troops had earned him the sobriquet of Fighting Parson. Located just northwest of Newark on the Passaic River, Caldwell had a population of no more than 1,000 in the 1830s, having doubled in size since 1800. It enjoyed a reputation for having such salubrious air that physicians recommended to their patients locating there as a cure-all for a medley of ailments. Like many such PennDOT communities, its coterie of farm families were supplied by a general store, a sawmill, a distillery, a local cider mill, and a blacksmith's shop. But its history was unique, and an inquisitive family like the Clevelands must have gloried in what they learned of it. The very road on which the Cleveland two-story frame house stood, now known as Bloomfield Avenue, had been the scene of the well-remembered Horseneck Riots of 1745, which pitted the settlers against the proprietors of New Jersey over land titles in what may be considered one of the earliest rebellions against the crown. As isolated and sleepy as small towns still were in the 1830s, a new epoch was emerging, although it was only in retrospect that people could know this was so. More than ever before, Americans, not only the Cleveland family, were on the move. After the Erie Canal was opened in New York in 1825, a canal-building frenzy gripped the country. By the time the Panic of 1837 put an end to the canal boom, it was possible to travel along internal waterways from New York to New Orleans. All in all, 3,000 miles of canals crisscrossed the country, mostly in the north. Yet the horse remained ubiquitous for most transportation until well into the next century. It was the railroad, though, its route not bound by the availability of rivers and lakes, that became the great binder of the nation, its tracks serving as giant straps connecting the sections better than ever before. Whereas there were 2,800 miles of rail in 1840, a decade later, there were 9,000. It was plain to see that the cars, as railroads soon were called, remade every town center that they reached. Their arrival on schedule forced people to be mindful of the clock. Everything, it appeared, was being done in railroad time now, and life was noticeably speeding up. Henry David Thoreau, who was fascinated by the iron horse, breathing fire and smoke from its nostrils, asked even as he knew the answer, "Do people not talk and think faster in the depot than in the stage office?" New states constantly coming into the Union added every few years to the number of stars in the flag. Arkansas in 1836, Michigan the following year, Florida and Texas in 1845, Wisconsin in 1848, and California in 1850. It is safe to guess that the Clevelands, even in their quiet little town, felt the vibrations from these developments, but their way of living was no different from those of their 18th century forebears.